know, you get your heavenly reward by doing God's will now, going hard after God now.
Right, right. And, hey, that's good. I mean, and there's a big attaboy, you know, at the end of it, and great. Uh-huh. But how long are you going to be able to go on that attaboy, you know? You know that one time when Jesus said, well done, that was cool. You remember that? That was cool. I was right there in front of everybody. Everybody, you know, and he took, and he said, well done. You remember that? Yeah, that was awesome. You know, 100 billion years later, hey, man, you remember that? You remember that time? It's like, yeah, Nathan, we heard it. Shut up.
Welcome, everyone, to the Faith Recovery Podcast. I'm Kent.
I'm Nathan.
And we're trying to recover faith by recovering the faith. And we're in a series called Redefining Faith. And this is the final episode.
Mm, and fitting, believe that.
Fittingly, the topic is the apocalypse.
Now,
we've been doing in this whole entire series is trying to correct misconceptions. Here's a misconception. A dreadful day is coming when God will destroy the world to punish sinful people. Those who are rescued will live in a disembodied state in a metaphysical realm, worshiping God forever. Okay, so Nathan's saying there's some misconceptions about the apocalypse there. And here's his correction, his redefinition. Mm. Christ will return to cleanse the earth through fire and recreate it as a place for God and humankind to dwell together.
Mm, crazy stuff.
That sounds good.
I like it.
I like Earth.
Yeah.
I think it's a great place.
It's not too bad. Yeah.
As a planet.
Yeah.
I like it.
Mm. I was at Disney World a few years ago, and I was like, man, there's a lot of people on the planet today that are never going to see this place. And I was like, that's okay. You know, it's like Jesus is coming back. It's going to be way cooler, you know. But there are some wonderful things on Earth that some people are never going to have the chance to see. And I think when Jesus comes back, he's gonna fix that. And everything's going to be, like, way better. So I like that idea.
So it's going to be what is good about Earth retained.
Yeah.
And what was wrong about the human experience.
Yeah.
Dealt with, done away with.
Yeah.
Fixed.
Yeah. God's purpose for creation fully realized, maybe, you know, that.
So part of what you're correcting here is the point where it's understood commonly that God is going to destroy the world and take us away from the physical universe and put us in a spiritual only metaphysical realm.
Right, yeah. So, and honestly, I guess I'm a bit out of touch, and I don't know what absolutely everybody out there thinks, but the way I came up was the eschatology was that those who've died are righteous people who've died are in their final state. They're enjoying the presence of God and all that. But then at the end of all things, there would be this rapture where people are zipped away and they go to that place, you know, to heaven or whatever. And then Jesus comes back and he judges the evil people on the world, I guess, sends them to hell or whatever. There may be some kind of final judgment scene. And then all things are, I mean, I guess nasty things happen on Earth. There's the tribulation and all that for a while. But then Jesus brings it to a close. I guess in some people's concept, he rules on Earth for 1,000 years over physical Israel. Mm-hmm. But then at the end of that, it's all zipped up and done. You know, everybody packs their bags and they go home. And home is the immediate presence of God in heaven, in heavenly realm. So that was kind of what I was taught.
That convoluted end time scenario is based on some cobbled together, you know, patchwork of various passages, interpreting various different passages literally, when maybe they should be interpreted figuratively or symbolically. Anyway, people have got their passages to support all those different ideas. And I guess we didn't really come here today to debunk every one of those ideas, like the rapture and the literal 1,000-year reign. Those are all prevalently held beliefs, or at least they used to be.
Mm-hmm.
We are seeming to discuss, and we are seeming to imply that we believe that we're in this age.
Mm-hmm.
Christ will return and begin the next age. That it's as simple as that.
Right. Yeah, and I read a book, I guess, when I was in school, and they were talking about, the guy asked the question, is if we're going to live in heaven, then why would Jesus come back? You know?
Why not just take us away to heaven and then destroy this place?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Why even bother? You know? So.
Good point.
That was a good question. I was like, why come here? Why go through all this rigmarole? You know? Why have 1,000 years on where Jesus is reigning on earth and, under a Levitical system? You know, where the law of Moses is fully restored and Israel, physical Israel, is the capital and toe the line or you get murked, you know? I mean, what is this? You look back on the theocracy that was Israel and it does not look, from my perspective, and I think I'm in the perspective of somebody who believes the gospel, who sees it as the fulfillment of physical Israel's history, right? So I'm not really a dispensationalist in that I think that God had these times, but there does seem to be some sort of a, almost like stages of a rocket, you know? And so as those have their role and they're cohesively part of one rocket, but the whole Levitical system is not something that was the ideal. It was the part of the, that fuselage, that part that is supposed to get the rocket into orbit, but it's, or wherever it's going, but it certainly drops off, at least if you're thinking about old Apollo rockets and stuff. I guess nowadays we don't have that. We're not so wasteful. Thanks, Elon. In my concept, as I think of something going out into space, there was a lot that was stacked up that was there to be, it had a real legitimate purpose, but it wasn't supposed to make it to space. Mm-hmm. It wasn't supposed to be part of the final destination. And it seems that the gospel is this thing that is very light and it has all the momentum that it needs and everything. And it's the culmination of all of that,
And it gets us to space. And space is union with God.
Yeah.
And that's the vision of heaven, is union with God.
Right.
God and humanity united. Oh, and it's a common nowadays to say heaven and earth united.
Mm-hmm.
And that does seem to be the biblical vision.
It is,
We're talking about an apocalypse that ushers in a new heavens and new earth, which is now one,
right?
One reality, not two separate realities where there's earth here and heaven there, but heavens and earth united.
Right. So, the Bible Project has a great video called Heaven and Earth or something where they explain that, and I think they do a great job. For me, that was kind of landmark because it was always hard to get my head around this idea of living in a metaphysical realm. So the depiction of the great city in Revelation, right? And there's this streets of gold and, worship of God's happening and this big tree is planted and all this, right? Which is fine. Be a nice place to visit. You know what I'm saying? It's just, okay. Were we created for final retirement? Is this finite, messy life on earth where we're just, we spend 80% of it saying, God, what do you want me to do? And thinking we probably missed our shot and are trying to recover what we've lost. And, there's so much here. And even if you read the biographies of the people that we would consider great saints, man, they spun their wheels and wandered around. I mean, even Jesus himself, what did he actually accomplish on this planet, as far as measurable results from his personal efforts, right? Like, he accomplished so much more in dying than he did in life. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, there have been religious figures who've had a greater following than he had. I mean, how do you measure Jesus' ministry and its effect? Okay, if it weren't for the gospel, if it's not for the cross and the empty tomb, you know, great, respectable guy, said some great stuff, you know, but at the end of the day, even his closest allies, his friends, abandoned him. You know, he didn't build some sort of enduring legacy apart from the gospel, you know, mm-hmm. apart from the action of his Father in response to his gracious self-sacrifice, you know. So if we see heaven as kind of this final reward where everyone's just there enjoying the fruit of what they did on earth, man, that puts a lot of weight on what we get done here, and maybe we should be more sober about it, but it doesn't make a ton of sense either, you know. It's like, hey, you're in a flawed body, and, you know, after a certain age, you're deteriorating anyway, and, you know, you only have so many options, you're surrounded by evil, you're facing opposition all the time, and that existence is determining everything. That's the full balance of everything you were put here for. And you're going to spend an incomprehensible existence with the results of that and the consequences of that, you know. That does seem a little out of whack. I mean, it's almost like if you say, you know, Johnny, you better do good in kindergarten. You know,
because it's all riding on kindergarten.
How you do in kindergarten is going to determine the rest of your life. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I already think it's dumb that somebody who's 18 has to make decisions that they're going to have to live with the rest of their life, and we know that's true, and that happens, and they do, they make choices, and we live with that. But I'm talking about someone who's very, very malformed, or not very not malformed, but you know, very immature, right? And not fully, their brain's not fully developed, and they have very limited perspective and everything, and we put all the weight of their whole life, you know. It's like, you know, hey Johnny, we fed you and we've clothed you, and you know, and now it's kindergarten, man, this is the big show, you know. You either learn to read or you don't, pal. And if you can't achieve, you can't accomplish, then you're done, you know. It doesn't seem like very. We wouldn't do that,
you're,
right?
You're talking about now this rewards view of heaven,
yeah.
And there is in evangelical Christianity pretty strong emphasis on that. You know, get your heavenly reward by doing God's will.
Yeah,
now, going hard after God now.
Right, right. And hey, that's good. I mean, and there's a big attaboy, you know, at the end of it, and great. Uh-huh. But how long are you going to be able to go on that attaboy, you know? You know that one time when Jesus said, well done, that was cool. You remember that? That was cool. I was right there in front of everybody. Everybody, you know, and he took, and he said, well done. You remember that? Yeah, that was awesome. You know, 100 billion years later, hey, man, you remember that? You remember that time? It's like, yeah, Nathan, we heard it. Shut up. You know?
I think you're wanting to say the emphasis needs to be on what God's going to do,
yeah,
to fix everything.
Right.
And usher in a new heavens and a new earth.
For us.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and there's something, I think that this is a big universe. You know, we're in something that is so almost incomprehensibly vast. I mean, I wonder if it's as big as it looks, and it's not a conspiracy theory so much as it's like Schrodinger's cat. Right.
I heard about Schrodinger's cat, right. But I don't remember anything about that cat.
So Schrodinger's cat is this illustration for quantum mechanics and the observer phenomenon with quantum mechanics, so that things are only a certain way in the quantum realm when are looking
observed.
At them.
Yeah.
Right. And so Schrodinger's cat is this illustration, and I guess must came up with some guy named Schrodinger, I guess, but at any rate, who was basically saying, what, the cat's only in the box when you're looking at it, you know, so someone brings a box and they say there's a cat in here, And when you open the box, there's a cat in there. But when you close the box, there's really not a cat in there. and so that's kind of like how I envision it's possible. So I'm just saying it's possible that as we get more powerful microscopes and telescopes, and we probe deeper out in the universe, that God's like, yeah, there's, you know, that almost like he's allowing us to see something more, right? So maybe it's there all the time, but it's not relevant. That's neither here nor there. Okay, I'm just saying that the universe appears to respond to human consciousness, or to maybe a grander consciousness, and so the size of it's almost irrelevant, because it really only has to do with whether you can see it, right? So maybe a tree that falls in the woods doesn't make a sound if nobody hears it. That's neither here nor there. But I'm saying that the universe appears to be very vast. What if it's possible, okay, that when Jesus comes back, we're supposed to just go out and explore? You know, what if our minds are are unlocked? Excuse me. What if our minds are unlocked and we are able to just master space travel? Or what if this consciousness thing, we realize that it's everything, and we're just able to travel on a stream of consciousness, literally. So if you're aware of a thing, you can go there. Mm-hmm. You know, so you develop a great telescope, and that allows you to go there. Instead of just seeing it, you're like, that's cool, I wonder what that's like. Bip. You know? Mm-hmm. So you're in an incorruptible body. Maybe, you know, you have a certain degree of mastery over the material realm, like Jesus did in his resurrection. So Jesus comes back, he's raised from the dead. He seems to have some upgrades. Mm-hmm. Can walk through walls, potentially be in multiple places at once, teleport. Mm-hmm. You know, so he's in a physical body. He's eating. He's, you know, his people can touch him. He's recognizable to some degree. Mm-hmm. He has the marks of his earthly life. Mm-hmm. At the same time, he's somehow able to do things that he couldn't do, even though he performed miracles. There was a lot of limitations on his physical existence, right? I mean, he could. Yeah, he could heal people, but it wasn't always like bip, you know. Sometimes he like had to spit in somebody's eye, and then that didn't take, you know. And there he's like, well, it's kind of, I don't know, like trees walking around, maybe, you know. It's like, dude, what, why, you know. Says he couldn't perform any miracles at Nazareth because they didn't believe. Mm-hmm. So there's limitations on him in his pre-resurrection body. In his post-resurrection body, it just seems effortless. You know, it's like, have you caught anything? You know, like he does the fish thing again. So there's this continuity, right? Mm-hmm. But also just this ability to, like I said, just walk through a wall, just enter a room that's locked. At least he never did that before his resurrection. So there's some mastery over the material realm that Jesus had in his resurrection. So he's corporeal. You can touch him. Mm-hmm. But he's not limited by the physical realm. So what if that is a picture of the renewed state? You know, Paul says that when a person is resurrected, they receive a spiritual body, right? Not a corruptible body. So what is a spiritual body? I mean, that's almost like a contradiction in terms. We think of those as mutually exclusive, that which, you know, mm-hmm. spiritual is not flesh, but he's saying a spiritual flesh.
Right.
You know, what do you think of that? I mean, 1 Corinthians 15, he's very clear, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, Jesus had a body when he rose, and mm-hmm. I think Paul is basing his vision for our future on Jesus' resurrection
yeah.
body. So it's mm-hmm. like you were saying, he rose, his body rose, but mm-hmm. his body rose transformed.
Right.
So that's a spiritual body.
Right. Yeah. So, I tend to think that the spiritual body is just a body that, just like a spiritual person, you know, when Paul speaks of, he's giving advice to people about using their spiritual gifts in 1 Corinthians 14. And he says, but we only speak it to people who are spiritual, to those who can compare spiritual terms with spiritual realities. You know, So a spiritual person, in my view, is somebody who is under the influence of the Spirit to a major degree. They traffic in that. Okay, so I would say that a spiritual body, and this is my opinion, neither here nor there, I guess. But if we have to make conjecture, I mean, we've been presented with an idea by Paul, spiritual body. Okay. My understanding of it, and the only way I can reconcile that, what seems to be a contradiction in terms, is that it is a body that purely obeys the Spirit. Okay, so for most of us, we began life spiritually dead, where our spirits may not even have surfaced, or had any kind of influence over anything we did. And then at some point, we were called to life in that first resurrection we talked about previously.
Born again,
right? And so now our spirit is alive. Our spirit is, so if we think of humans as tripartite, body, soul, and spirit, okay, that innermost self, that some people are just body and soul in terms of the way they function. They don't function beyond their own personal desires and implications, just looking at their own consequences and their reason and stuff like that. But some people are functioning by faith. And I think faith is that way that we begin to access the spirit, the spiritual side of us, okay? And that's an element of us that in most people is suppressed, and even in redeemed people is recovering. Mm-hmm. We're like Paul says, if you by the Spirit put to death the deeds of the body, you will live. So there's this connection between the body being put into a place of subservience or submission underneath the spiritual self. Whereas, previously the spiritual self was inert and suppressed by physical drives. Okay, now there's a revolving of that so that the physical self is under the sway of the spiritual self. So we find that in a volitional sense, like when I decide to pursue Christ and I subject my flesh to crucifixion or whatever, what comes forth is the spiritual man. Okay? So that we see that on a volitional way. There are people who are able to, I think, bring their body under their spirit, and maybe under their soul, like our will. Some people can just activate their soul to a place that their body comes, because ultimately the body should be following what the soul wants, and the soul should be following what the spirit wants. Okay, there are some people that maybe are spiritually dead, but they've mastered the art of subjecting their body to their soul, their will. Okay, so I think about people who are maybe Zen Buddhists and stuff, who can take up take up like burning coals and stuff like that and not be harmed. So that ought to tell us that it's not all atoms in motion. Mm-hmm. That someone has activated their spirit, their soul, and their will, and maybe there's a demonic component to that. I mean, I don't want to be too critical of other people, but there's some way that those people have learned to hack the system.
The system, yeah.
Right. So they're activating some of this, these forces that for most of us appear impossible or not available, that our bodies would be subject to our non-material self. Okay. But what I see in Jesus after his resurrection is someone whose body is entirely obedient to his non-material self. So that if his non-material self wants to be in the room where you are, it is, mm-hmm. and his body has to go along. Mm-hmm. So it's not so far-fetched. Really, if you compare it to people who perhaps mastered things like meditation and are using, these powers, whatever you want to call them, okay? But this is something even greater than that. So what if somebody is able to do that, but, on a massive scale? Like, that's just the normal existence. Whatever your spirit and your soul want, your body must do. And, so if you need to be in outer space, fine. if you need to be at some other place, you don't really necessarily need a livable environment. Your body is now just the vehicle of the rest of you, And I don't know what limits and stuff there would be to that. But all that to say is that I think that when Jesus comes back and Earth is renewed, that we're going to have really some amazing work to do. Mm-hmm. You know, because the gates of that city, you know, as the city is depicted in Revelation, right? So there's this great city that comes down and lands on earth. Mm-hmm. The gates of the city remain open. Remember that? You know, it's like, why have gates at all? I mean, if that's everything, I mean, hey, it's 1,500 miles by 1,500 miles. It's a pretty good sized place, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it's a city that, what, it's about the size of half the United States or something. So it's a big city. That's great. But, you know, we're going to get bored there. I mean, for eternity. And maybe very spiritual people would say, well, no, we're just going to be caught up in the presence of God and it's going to be amazing. Yeah, okay. But even God created everything, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. Even he wants to be productive and express himself, and we're created in his image. And I think that that's the kinds of things that we're going to do. It's not really this Mormon idea where you're made of God and you create your own universe, but it's something where we will spend eternity innovating, creating for his glory, so that when we, you know, when it says, and the kings of the earth bring their wealth into it, you know, well, who is that? And what's this wealth? Mm-hmm. You know, so that there may be this headquarters, and it may be on earth. I mean, it seems to be suggested, you know, but, and I think we will live on a renewed earth, but I don't know if we will be limited to it. I just think that we're going to be just like my 5-year-old, you know, example, that we will be just these multiple orders of magnitude beyond in terms of our capacities where we are now. You know, I mean, really where we are now, our capacity right now is probably more akin to infant, you know, mm-hmm. compared to what we will be. Mm-hmm. So to me, that's a more of an exciting vision of the future, that there's going to be this universe it's pulsing with life and renewal. It's not, I mean, everything in the universe is subject to entropy right now. Everything is degrading, even on a astrophysical level, you know, I mean, and really that's one of the great mysteries of astrophysics is, why is this degrading? You know, this Doppler effect that nobody can really argue with. We know that the universe is trending toward heat death, total, you know, annihilation just through slow decline. Why is that? You know, because when we roll it backward, what we don't, you know, the rules that are accompanying this acceleration outward don't make sense. Okay, it's accelerating faster than it should be, and we don't know what's holding it together given the rate that it's accelerating. You know, there's so much we don't know about this degradation, but what I would suggest is that when Jesus comes back, this universe is either going to, you know, it's either going to stop or it's going to begin to move back to where it needs to be, that the degradation in general is going to stop, and that there will be, instead of degradation, there will just be renewal, you know, there will be invigoration. Not only for us, but for everything in what we would consider the observable universe. So, because, you know, people have observed this universe is just too daggum big for the human race.
And in, like, Romans 8, Paul describes the earth, the creation is groaning for the revealing of the sons of God, so that he's got this vision of how we will be raised from the dead, but so will the creation.
Right, yeah. He says in Romans 8:18, you read my mind there. We've been doing this too long. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I consider that our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in us. For the creation waits in eager expectation for the children of God to be revealed. Isn't that great? You know, this idea that here you have a kingdom that's just laying maybe in waste, you know? Waiting for these beings who've been given charge of it, who are supposed to be its superintendents, but they're not, they haven't ascended to their role yet. You know, it's very much like this picture of creation in Genesis 2. We don't begin with Adam in Genesis 2. We begin with a creation that is untended. you know? And I really think that's the picture, with, that there's a universe that's waiting to be tended, you know? And so it's waiting for the revelation of the children, for the children of God to be revealed, for the creation was subjected to frustration or to vanity, futility, by its, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the freedom and glory of the children of God. And I guess that's what I'm talking about this upgraded body, that really it's freedom. Mm-hmm. You know, because even now we can be free volitionally, but we're not free from things like sickness, right? We're not free from, I don't know, physical consequences. You know, there are certain things that we're not free from, but he's talking about a kind of freedom that's even, you know, that's going to excel that, maybe even beyond what we can conceive. So we know that the whole creation has been groaning as in the pains of childbirth right up to this present time. And not only so, but we ourselves who have the first fruits of the Spirit. And again, this idea of the Spirit being the engine that's going to reverse this corruption, you know, groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for the adoption to sonship, the redemption of our bodies. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we were talking about, that this conversion of our actual bodies to something worthy of this new creation. So that's a lot more exciting to me. It makes a lot more sense. And it seems like something worth, you know, looking forward to. Mm-hmm. That there are going to be these, I don't know, God's not done. And, you know, when heaven and earth are united, I don't think that that's going to be
just getting started.
The end of it. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's the beginning of a new age. Mm-hmm. And just like this age has had its up and downs and history, and, you know, I don't think the new age is necessarily going to have the downs, I guess, as much as the mess, but I think it will have its own challenges and its, you know, the goals and the exploits and the things that we, you know, would be given to do and seek to do. I think those will still be there. I think it would be a, you know, so I think we'll come back to this city and bring the results, you know, or whatever, that there will be this joyful achievement of just the glory of God, you know, this expansion of his glory through individual beings who are totally free, but who are his children and made in his image, you know. I mean, did God make this universe to appreciate it alone? You know, to inhabit it alone? Or did he make it so that it could be ruled over by his progeny? You know? And so it seems to me to be the latter, especially, you know, Paul talks about that we are co-heirs with Christ. You know? What does that even mean? You know? It sounds to me like we are sons of God, like, you know, royalty, like having some serious authority and power to do some stuff, you know? So, yeah, that's kind of how I see the final state. I don't know if that's what I was thinking. I think it is when I wrote that. But yeah, that's what I've got. And I think Jesus, when he comes back, he's coming back to stay. You mm-hmm. know, like the people that say, mm-hmm. you know, with this union of heaven and earth.
Uh-huh. Now now the dwelling of God is with men, mm-hmm. is the line in Revelation.
Yeah. Yeah. So he's coming to be here with us. And it does get back to this idea of, you know, what are we going to rule over? I mean, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 6, we'll judge angels. So I suppose we get a major promotion, you know, and it gets to that Psalm 8 outline where, and I think that the author of Hebrews sees Psalm 8 as really a depiction of the big plan and this messianic pattern. And so there's this, I'll just go to it, but, remember, the messianic pattern is this upside down V, right? Where there's a descent and then an elevation. Okay. And so if you can imagine, and remember that a chiasmus was a very popular way of writing. So a chiasmus is writing in the shape of an X. Okay, so we would have an outline that would go A, subpoint, 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 B, subpoint, 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 C, subpoint, D, subpoint. Okay, they would have an outline that would go, that would have roughly that structure, right? So let's just say ABC. They would have point ABC, but that would then they would go CBA. Okay, so mm-hmm. point A, first point, would be connected to point A2, right? Mm-hmm. Which would be the sixth or the fifth point. Yeah. Or the sixth, depending on if they repeated that middle idea. Mm-hmm. That middle idea is probably the main idea of what you want to say. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, that's kind of the linchpin for the argument. But then that point is supported by and bracketed by points B and A mm-hmm. moving out. Okay, so that's a chiasmus, all right? And Psalm 8, people who were Greek speakers were very familiar with chiastic structure, okay? I'm not exactly sure whether that was true in the Hebrew writings, but people who were Greek speakers who read Psalm 8 would have seen a chiasmus, I think, in this structure, okay? So I guess it's there. And so Psalm 8 begins with, Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth, right? You've set your glory in the heavens. And through the praise of children and infants, you've established a stronghold against your enemies to silence the foe and the avenger. Okay, so verse 1, Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. And then verse 9, the final verse of Psalm 8, Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. So you can kind of see the beginning of a chiastic structure. Mm-hmm. And then he says, through the praise of infants, you know, you've established a stronghold against your enemies. Okay. And he says, when I consider the heavens, the work of your fingers, sun, moon, and stars. So there's this kind of paean to the creation, right? But then he says, what is mankind that you are mindful of them? And, so this is a, NIV is more gender inclusive, and unfortunately, and I'm all for gender inclusive language in the Bible, okay. But unfortunately, in this case, that they've made plurals where there were singulars, mm-hmm. okay. So really, it is what is humanity, what is mankind that you're mindful of them, or the Son of Man that you care for him. Mm-hmm. So we go from all of humankind to an individual representative member who is called Son of Man. Then we revisit Son of Man in verse 5, and it says, you have made him a little lower than the angels and crowned him with glory and honor. Okay, that's in the Hebrew. Okay, mm-hmm. first or third person, singular, masculine. Okay, now the author of Hebrews saw in that a chiastic structure where verses 4 and 5 are the main point. They're that point C. Mm-hmm. And Jesus is sitting there at the cross, mm-hmm. you know, because remember, chiastic is an X shape. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so he's sitting there at the crux of this psalm. Jesus is. He was made a little lower than the angels. You crowned him. So here's a telling of the gospel of this messianic pattern mm-hmm. of somebody who's been made lower, right? And then he says, you made them, expands again. So now we're back to B, remember? If that middle, if verses 4 and 5 are C, verses 3 and 6 are B, right? You've made them rulers over the works of your hands. You put everything under his feet, slash their feet, in this case. Okay. And then it returns to this idea of the creation, right? All flocks and herds and animals of the wild. So, you know, God is ruler over all things in in our A point, which would be verses 1 and 2, and then in verses 3 and the beginning of 4, I guess. 3 and 4 is really point B. Verse 5 would be C, point C, the crux, I guess. Verses 6 and 6 through 8 would be point B again, and then verse 9 would be point A in this chiastic structure.
If Nathan just lost you, all you have to do is get out your Bible and read. And when you're reading, it's Psalm 8, and it's Psalm 8 interpreted in the book of Hebrews chapter...
I don't...
you're just going from memory on Hebrews.
You're in
Psalm 8. So a person could open their Bibles in Psalm 8, rewind, and then follow you through Psalm 8. Okay, we'll just pick up where you are.
I'll find it in a minute. But at any rate, and the Hebrew writer is saying... He's talking about how his point in the earlier chapters of Hebrews, so in Hebrews 1 through 5 or so, he's saying that Jesus is higher than the angels, right? That the Old Testament came through angels, Jesus is higher than the angels, therefore the new covenant supersedes the old, is kind of his point through the book of Hebrews. And he really uses Psalm 8, Psalm 110 to kind of make his point, okay? But he says, now we see him, Jesus, made higher than the angels, but we don't see ourselves that way yet, So there's this penultimate state. So in his envisioning this, that as Jesus becomes one of our race and he descends beneath us in a way, then he descended beneath us to rise above all things so that he takes us with him, and that's what he sees in Psalm 8. So there's this ruling over all things that we're supposed to join him in, so we could see it as creation, and it is, this cultural mandate that we're supposed to rule over all things. But we clearly haven't done a very good job of that, And I would say that when Jesus comes back, Jesus becomes the archetypal human, right? Who he joins creation, but he rises to our original purpose, our original call, and takes us with him on the way through. So author of Hebrews would say, so we're right there, we're kind of between verse 5 and 6, where Jesus is seated above all things, but he's not, but we don't see ourselves risen, above all things. And so that's what we're waiting for, is this redemption where we're going to join him as stewards and heirs of creation. So that's it, man. That's what I got for you.
Man, that's so great. Thank you. That's a good vision. That's a good hope. That's a good future.
I like it.
If you want to discuss that more with us, you can always email us at discussion@recoverfaith.org. Thanks for being with us, and we'll see you next time.